2. Ice Ship Hornet, Lake Pei, the Temple Lands. The Earl of Corus had never been colder in his entire life, which, after the last few months of winter travel, was saying quite a lot. At the moment, however, he didn't really care. In fact, at the moment, he wasn't even worrying about the imminence of his arrival in the city of Zion, or what was going to happen after he finally got there. He was too busy trying not to whoop in sheer exuberance as the ice boat Hornet went slicing across Lake Pei's endless plain of ice, like Langhorne's own razor in a scatter of rainbow-struck ice chips. He'd never imagined anything like it. Even the descriptions Hollis Tanner had shared with him over meals or an occasional tankard of beer on the wearisome overland trip from Fairstock to Lakeview had been inadequate. Not for lack of trying, or because Father Hollis had lacked either the enthusiasm or the descriptive gift for the task, but simply because Corus's imagination had never been given anything to use for comparison. If anyone had asked him, he would have simply discounted out of hand the possibility that anyone could ever travel faster than, say, 15 miles an hour. To be honest, even that would have seemed the next best thing to starkly impossible, except possibly in a sprint by specially bred horses. Slash lizards were faster than that when they charged. He'd heard estimates that put their speed in a dash as high as 40 miles an hour. But no human being had ever ridden a slash lizard, except very briefly in certain fables, whose entire purpose was to demonstrate the unwisdom of making the attempt. Now, as showers of ice flew like diamond dust from the ice boat's screaming runners, and the incredible vibration hammered into him through his feet and legs, Corus was finally experiencing what Tanner had tried to explain to him, and a corner of the Earl's mind went back over the past wearisome 5 days of travel, which had brought him to this moment. The sheer, slow, slogging misery of their journey along the Raworth Valley, where it formed the open north-south V at the heart of the Wishbone Mountains, had only served to make Tanner's descriptions of his ice boat speed even less believable. The only redeeming aspect of the trip, perversely enough, had been the snowy conditions with which they'd been forced to cope. The outsized sleighs Tanner had procured had made surprisingly good time, indeed better time than carriages or even mounted men might have made over those winter-struck roads, behind the successive teams of six-limbed snow lizards the underpriest had arranged via the church's semaphore system. The snow lizards, unlike the sleigh's passengers, hadn't minded the icy temperatures and snow at all. Their multiply pelts provided near-perfect insulation, not to mention, Corus had discovered at one of the posting houses in which they had overnighted, the most sinfully sensual rugs any man had ever walked barefoot across, and their huge feet, with the webs between their pads, carried them across even the deepest snow. They were considerably smaller than the mountain lizards used for draft purposes in more temperate climes, but they were close to twice the size of a good saddle horse. And while they would have found it difficult to match a horse in a sprint, they had all of lizardkind's endurance, which meant they could maintain almost indefinitely a pace which would have quickly exhausted or even killed any horse. The snow lizards would have been perfectly happy padding along into the very teeth of a Wishbone Mountains blizzard. Assuming the wind had gotten too bad even for them, they would simply have curled up into enormous balls, two or three of them huddling together whenever possible, and allowed the howling wind to cover them in a comfortable blanket of snow. Human beings, unfortunately, were somewhat more poorly insulated, and so, even with the snow lizards' help, Corus and Tanner had found themselves weatherbound on three separate occasions, once for almost 3 days. Mostly, they'd used church posting houses, since most of the inns, which seemed to be considerably larger than those to which Corus was accustomed, appeared to have closed their doors for the winter. Not surprisingly, he'd supposed, given how the weather had undoubtedly inspired all but the hardiest or most lunatic of travelers to stay home until spring. Even the posting houses had been both larger and rather more luxurious than he would have anticipated. But given the number of high-ranking churchmen who frequently traveled this route, he'd realized he shouldn't have been particularly surprised by that discovery. The weather delays had been frustrating enough, despite the comfort of the posting houses, but the shortness of the winter days hadn't helped either, even though the snow lizards had been perfectly happy to keep going even in near total darkness. They'd stretched their travel time each day as far as they could, yet there'd been stretches, even in the sheltered and relatively low-lying valley, where the roads had been far too sinuous, steep, and icy for anyone but an idiot to traverse them in darkness. Considering all that, the Earl hadn't been particularly surprised to find Tanner's original estimate of how long the trip would take had actually been a bit optimistic. Despite that, they'd finally reached Lakeview, once again inevitably in the middle of a dense snowfall. Night had already fallen by the time they arrived, and the ancient city's buildings had seemed to huddle together, hunching shoulders and roofs against the weather. Many of the city's windows had been shuttered against the cold, but the glow of lamplight streaming from others had turned the falling snowflakes into a dancing, swirling tapestry woven by invisible sprites. Their traveling sleighs had slowed dramatically once they reached Lakeview streets, yet the darkness and the weather had already urged most of the city's inhabitants inside, and they'd quickly reached the Archangel's Rest, the harborside inn where rooms had been reserved for them. It was a huge establishment, a full 6 stories tall, with palatial sleeping chambers and a full-fledged ground-floor restaurant. In fact, the Archangel's Rest dwarfed anything Corus had ever seen in Coruscant, or even the largest of the outsized inns they'd passed en route from Fairstock. For that matter, he was pretty sure it was larger than anything he'd ever seen anywhere, short of a cathedral in some capital city. It hardly seemed proper to describe it as a mere inn, and he supposed that was why someone had coined the word hotel to describe it instead. At the moment, however, it was clearly operating with a much reduced staff. He'd mentioned that to Tanner, and the underpriest had chuckled. "During the summer, the place is usually packed," he'd explained. "In fact, they usually wish they had even more rooms to let. Didn't you notice how much bigger the inns were along the high road?" Corus had nodded, and Tanner had shrugged. "Well, that's because when everything's not covered with ice and snow, there are usually thousands of pilgrims using the high road to make their way to or from the temple at any given time. All of them need some place to spend the night, after all, and all the roads to Lake Pei from the south come together here, which makes Lakeview the lakeside terminus for anyone traveling to Zion or the temple by road, just like Port Harbor is the major landfall for anyone traveling there by way of Xingwu's Passage. Trust me, if you were here at midsummer, you'd swear every adult on Safehold was trying to get to the temple, and that every one of them was trying to stay at the rest. This time of year, the top 3 floors are completely closed down, though. For that matter, I'd be surprised if more than a third, or even a quarter, of the rooms which haven't been closed for the winter are occupied at the moment. How in the world do they justify keeping it open at all if they lose so much of their business during the winter?" Corus had asked. "Well, the quality of their restaurant helps a lot," Tanner had laughed. "Trust me, you'll see that for yourself at supper." So they manage to keep their kitchen staff fully occupied, no matter what time of year it is. As for the rest, he'd shrugged. "Mother Church has a partial ownership in the rest, and the temple treasury helps subsidize expenses over the winter months. In fact, Mother Church has the same arrangement with quite a few of the larger inns and hotels here in Lakeview, and in Port Harbor, for that matter." Corus had nodded in understanding. For that matter, he'd realized he should have thought of that possibility for himself. Obviously, the church would have a powerful interest in providing housing for those performing the pilgrimage to the temple, enjoined upon all of the truly faithful by the Holy Writ. And, he'd thought just a bit more cynically, I'll bet the profit the treasury turns during the peak pilgrimage months is more than handsome enough to cover the costs of keeping the places open year-round. However that might have been, he'd been forced to admit the Archangel's Rest had provided the most comfortable and luxurious travel accommodations he'd ever encountered. And the contrast between it and the conditions they'd endured all too frequently elsewhere during their rigorous journey had been profound. He was certain that few of the hotel's other suites were quite as luxurious as the ones to which he and Tanner had been escorted, and the restaurant had been just as excellent as Tanner had promised. In fact, Corus had found himself wishing rather wistfully that they could have spent more than a single night as its guests. Unfortunately, he'd known they couldn't, and he'd tried to project an air of cheerful acceptance as he followed Tanner down to the docks the next morning. From the underpriest's obvious amusement, it had been clear he'd failed to fool the other man, but despite Tanner's lively sense of humor and the ridiculous, he'd managed somehow to refrain from teasing his charge. Corus had appreciated the underpriest's forbearance, and he suspected that his reaction, when he finally set eyes on Hornet for the first time, had constituted a sort of reward for Tanner's patience. He'd actually stopped dead, gazing at the ice boat in astonishment. Despite all the descriptions he'd heard, he hadn't been prepared for the reality when he saw the rakish vessel sitting there on the gleaming steel feet of its huge, skate-like runners. The mere thought of how much each of those runners must have cost was enough to give a man pause, especially if the man in question had first-hand experience in things like foundry costs, because he'd recently been involved in an effort to build a galleon-based, cannon-armed navy from scratch. Again, though, he'd realized he was looking at an example of the church's enormous financial resources. Ice boats like Hornet weren't just exorbitantly expensive. They were also highly specialized propositions, and their sole function was to cross Lake Pei after the enormous sheet of water had frozen solid. It was almost 450 miles from Lakeview to Zion, and every year, when winter truly set in, the lake became only marginally navigable. Indeed, once it had fully iced over, it was completely closed to normal shipping, and ice boats became the only way in or out of Zion. They couldn't begin to carry the amount of cargo conventional ships could, so a vast fleet would have been required to ship in any significant supply of foodstuffs or fuel, which meant neither Zion nor the temple could count on importing large amounts of either from their usual southern sources after the lake had begun freezing in earnest. But at least some freight, mostly luxury goods, and quite a few passengers still needed to cross, regardless of the season. And Mother Church had a monopoly where ice boat ownership was concerned. Hornet herself looked a great deal like a church courier galley on enormous skates. There were some differences, yet her courier ship ancestry had been clearly recognizable. And made some sense, Corus had supposed, given that there were occasions, especially early in the ice season, when, as Tanner had suggested, it wasn't unheard of for one of the ice boats to encounter a still open lead of unfrozen lake water. Or, for that matter, to rather abruptly discover that a sheet of ice was thinner than it had appeared. The ability to float in an instance like that was undoubtedly a good thing to have. Corus had never heard of something a native of Old Terra would have called a hydrofoil, but in many respects, that would have been a reasonable analog for what he was looking at. Hornet's outriggers extended much farther beyond the footprint of her hull, because unlike a hydrofoil, they had to plane across the surface of the ice rather than relying on hydrodynamics for stability. Aside from that, however, the principle was very much the same, and as he'd looked at the ice boat's lean, rakish grace, he'd realized Hollis Tanner was exactly the right sort of man to captain such a vessel. In his case, at least, the church had slipped a round peg neatly into an equally round hole, and Corus had found himself wondering just how typical of the Lake Pay ice boat captains Tanner truly was. The underpriest's pride in his command had been readily apparent, and the Earl's obvious admiration, or awe at least, had clearly gratified him. His crew's cheerfulness at seeing him had also been apparent, and they'd gotten Corus, Sea Blanket, and their baggage moved aboard and settled quickly. "The wind looks good for a fast passage, my lord," Tanner had told him, as the two of them stood on Hornet's deck, looking out across the frozen harbor. Despite the snow which had fallen overnight, wind had kept the ice scoured clear, and Corus had been able to see the scars of other ice boats' passages leading across the wide, dark sheet of ice and out through the opening in the Lakeview breakwater. At the moment, there had seemed to be very little breeze stirring at dockside, however, and he'd quirked an eyebrow at the underpriest. "Oh, I know there's not much wind right here," Tanner had replied with a grin. "Out beyond the breakwater, though, once we get out of Lakeview's lee, trust me, my lord, there's plenty of wind out there."
"I'm quite prepared to believe it," Corus had replied. "But just how do we get from here to there?"
"Courtesy of those, my lord." Tanner had waved a hand, and when Corus turned in the indicated direction, he'd seen a team of at least 30 snow lizards headed for them. "They'll tow us out far enough to catch the breeze," Tanner had said confidently. "It'll seem like that takes forever, but once we do, I promise, you'll think we're flying." Now, remembering the underpriest's promise, Corus decided Tanner had been right. The Earl had declined Tanner's offer to go below to the shelter of Hornet's day cabin. He'd thought he'd seen approval for his decision in the underpriest's eyes, and Tanner had entrusted him to the charge of a grizzled old seaman, or was that properly iceman, Corus had wondered, with instructions to find the Earl a safe spot from which to experience the journey. The tow away from the docks hadn't been nearly as laborious-seeming an affair as Tanner's description might have suggested. That could have been because Corus had never before experienced it, and so had no backlog of wonder-dulling familiarity to overcome. Unlike Tanner and his crew, he'd been seeing it for the very first time, and he'd watched in fascination as the snow lizards were jockeyed into position. It had been obvious the lizards had done this many times before. They and their drovers had moved with a combination of smooth experience and patience, and heavy chains and locking pins had clanked musically behind the frothing surface of commands and encouragement, as the heavy traces were attached to specialized towing brackets on Hornet's prow. Given the complexity of the task, they'd accomplished it in a remarkably short time, and then, encouraged by much louder shouts, the snow lizards had leaned into their collars with the peculiar, hoarse, almost barking whistles of effort with which Corus had become familiar over the last month or so. For a moment, the ice boat had refused to move. Then the runners had broken free of the ice, and she'd begun to slide gracefully after the straining snow lizards. Once they'd had her in motion, she moved easily enough, and as they'd eased steadily away from the docks, Corus had felt the first icy fingers of the freshening breeze, which Tanner had promised waited for them out on the lake. It had taken them the better part of 3/4 of an hour to get far enough out to satisfy Tanner, but then the snow lizards had been unhooked, the senior drover had waved cheerfully, and the tow team had headed back to Lakeview. Corus had watched them go, but only until crisp-voiced commands from the cramped quarterdeck had sent Hornet's crew to their stations for making sail. The closer-to-hand fascination of those preparations had drawn his attention away from the departing snow lizards, and he'd watched as the ice boat's lateen sail was loosed. In some ways, his familiarity with conventional ships had only made the process even more bizarre. Despite the fact that his brain had known there were probably hundreds of feet of water underneath them, he hadn't been able to shake the sense of standing on dry land, and there'd been an oddly dreamlike quality to watching sailors scurrying about a ship's deck when the gleaming ice had stretched out as far as the eye could see with rock-steady solidity. But if he'd felt that way, he'd obviously been the only one on Hornet's deck who did. Or perhaps the others had simply been too busy to worry about such fanciful impressions. And they'd certainly known their business. That much had been clear as the sail had been loosed. The canvas had complained, flapping heavily in the stiff breeze whistling across the decks, and Hornet had stirred underfoot, as if the ice boat were shivering with eagerness. Then the sail had been sheeted home, the yard had been trimmed, and she'd begun to move. Slowly at first, with a peculiar grating and yet sibilant sound from her runners. The motion underfoot had been strange, vibrating through the deck planking with a strength and a hardness Corus had never experienced aboard any waterborne vessel. That wasn't exactly the right way to describe it, but Corus hadn't been able to think of a better one, and he'd reached out, touching the rail, feeling that same vibration, shivering throughout the vessel's entire fabric, and dancing gently in his own bones. The ice boat had gathered way slowly in the beginning, but as she'd slid steadily farther out of Lakeview's wind shadow, she'd begun to accelerate steadily. More quickly, in fact, than any galley or galleon, and Corus had felt his lips pursing in sudden understanding. He should have thought of it before, he'd realized, when Tanner first described Hornet's speed to him. On her runners, the ice boat avoided the enormous drag, water resistance imposed on a normal ship's submerged hull. Of course, she accelerated more rapidly, and without that selfsame drag, she had to be much faster in any given set of wind conditions. Which was exactly what she'd proven to be.
"Enjoying yourself, my lord?"
Hollis Tanner had to practically bellow in Corus's ear for the question to be heard over the slithering roar of the runners. Corus hadn't noticed him approaching. He'd been too busy staring ahead, clinging to the rail while his eyes sparkled with delight, and he turned quickly to meet Hornet's captain's gaze.
"Oh, I certainly am, father," the Earl shouted back. "I'm afraid I didn't really believe you when you told me how fast she was. She must be doing, what, 40 miles an hour?"
"Not in this wind, my lord," Tanner shook his head. "She's fast, but it would take at least a full gale to move her that quickly. We might be making 30, though."
Corus had no choice but to take the underpriest's word for it. And, he admitted, he himself had no experience at judging speeds this great.
"I'm surprised it doesn't feel even colder than it does," he commented, and Tanner smiled.
"We're sailing with the wind, my lord. That reduces the apparent wind speed across the deck a lot. Trust me, if we were beating up to windward, you'd feel it then."
"No doubt I would," the Earl shook his head. "And I'll take your word for our speed. But I never imagined that anything could move this quickly, especially across a solid surface like this." "It helps that the ice is as smooth as it is out here," Tanner replied.
He waved one arm, indicating the ice around them, then pointed at yet another of the flagstaffs, all set upright in the lake's frozen surface, and supporting flags of one color or another, which Hornet had been passing at regular intervals since leaving Lakeside.
"See that?" he asked, and the Earl nodded.
This particular staff boasted a green flag, and Tanner grinned.
"Green indicates smooth ice ahead, my lord," he said. "Only a fool trusts the flags completely. That's why we keep a good lookout."
He twitched his head at a distinctly frozen-looking man perched in Hornet's crow's nest.
Still, the survey crews do a good job of keeping the flags updated. We should see yellow warning flags well before we come up on ridge ice, and the ridges themselves will be red flagged. And the flags also provide our piloting marks, like harbor buoys, for the crossing.
How in Langhorne's name do they get the flags planted in the first place?
Corus half-shouted the question through the exuberant roar of their passage, and Tanner's grin grew even broader.
Not too hard, really, once the ice sets up nice and hard, my lord. They just chop a hole, stand the staff in it, then let it refreeze.
But how do they keep the staff from just keeping going right down into the water?
It sits in a hollow bracket with crossbars,
Tanner replied, waving his hands as if to illustrate what he was saying.
The brackets are iron, about 3 feet tall, with two pairs of crossbars set at right angles about halfway along their length. The bars are a lot longer than the width of the hole, and they sit on top of the ice, holding the bracket in position while the hole freezes back over. Then they just step the flagstaff in the bracket. When we get closer to spring, they'll buoy each bracket to keep it from sinking when the ice melts, so they can recover them and use them again next winter.
Corus nodded in understanding, and the two of them stood side by side for several minutes, watching the ice blur past as Hornet slashed onward. Then Tanner stirred.
Assuming my speed estimate's accurate, and I modestly admit that I'm actually very good at estimating that sort of thing, my lord, we're still a good 11 or 12 hours out from Zion, he said. Normally I'd be guessing even longer than that, but the weather's clear, and we'll have a full moon tonight, so we're not going to have to reduce speed as much when we lose the daylight. But while I'm glad you're enjoying yourself up here, you might want to think about going below and getting something hot to drink. To be honest, I'd really like to get you delivered unfrozen, and we'll be coming up on lunch in another couple of hours as well, for that matter.
I'd prefer arriving unfrozen myself, I think, Corus replied. But I'd really hate to miss any of this.
He waved both arms, indicating the sunlight, the deck around them, the mast with its straining sail braced sharply, and the glittering ice chips showering away from the steadily grating runners as they tore through the bright, almost undeniably icy morning.
I know, and I'm not trying to order you below, my lord,
Tanner laughed out loud.
To be honest, I'd be a bit hypocritical if I did, given how much I enjoy it up here on deck. But you might want to be thinking ahead. And don't forget, you've got a full day of this to look forward to. Believe me, if you think it's exhilarating right now, wait till you see it by moonlight.
3. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. Silent snowflakes battered against the floor-to-ceiling windows like lost ghosts. The brilliant mystic lighting which always illuminated the outside of the temple turned the swirling flakes into glittering gems until the wind caught them and swept them to their rendezvous with the window. Howard Wilson watched them changing from gorgeous jewels into feathery ghosts and felt a coldness far deeper than that of the night beyond the windows, whispering in the marrow of his bones. He looked away from the transmuting snowflakes at the luxurious suite assigned to his brother. Every vicar had personal apartments in the enormous, majestic sweep of the temple, and as apartments went, Samuel Wilson's were not particularly huge. They weren't tiny, either, yet they were substantially more modest than a vicar of Samuel's seniority might have demanded. They were more plainly and simply furnished, too, without the sumptuous luxury other vicars required. Jaspar Clinton, the current Grand Inquisitor, was a case in point. It was rumored, almost certainly correctly, that the art treasures in his chambers alone were probably worth the total annual income of most baronies. And that didn't even consider the fact that Clinton had demanded and received one of the coveted corner apartments, with windows looking both east and north, allowing him to survey the roofs, towers, and buildings of the city of Zion through one set, and the magnificent dome and colonnade of the main temple through the other. Howard supposed that one could make the argument, as Clinton obviously did, that such quarters were merely in keeping with the office of the man responsible for overseeing the state of Mother Church's soul. More than once he'd heard Clinton piously declaiming about the need to properly support the authority and prestige of the Grand Inquisitor, of the need to emphasize the necessary, always necessary, extent of that official's authority over all of Mother Church's children in ways which even the most worldly soul might recognize. To reach out to those too easily impressed by the trappings and power of this world in ways which even they could not ignore. It was never about his own gluttonous, greedy, debauched, power-mongering personal lifestyle or desires. Oh, Langhorne, no! Howard felt his lips tightening and acid churned in his stomach as he compared his brother's chosen simplicity, the absence of statuary, the dearth of priceless carpets, the lack of stupendous oil paintings by the greatest master's Safehold had ever produced, with Clinton's. There were paintings on Samuel's walls, but they were portraits of both his first and his current wife, his three sons, his two daughters, his son-in-law, and his first grandchild. The furniture was comfortable and certainly not cheap, yet it was only furniture, selected because it was comfortable and not to emphasize the importance of its owner. And the artworks which adorned his bookshelves and prayer desk were modest and understated, almost all exquisitely wrought, but most of them by lesser-known artists he had chosen to support with his patronage, because something about the pieces had touched his own heart, his own soul and faith.
If Samuel had only won the election, Howard thought bitterly, he came so close. In fact, I'm still not convinced Clinton really won. That lickspittle Reyno was in charge of the vote count after all, and look where he wound up.
Of course, if Samuel had won, if he'd become the new Grand Inquisitor instead of Clinton, the vast gulf between the fashion in which he would have furnished his apartments in the temple and the fashion in which Clinton had done the same thing would have been the least of Mother Church's differences.
For one thing, this damned schism would never have happened. Samuel would never have signed off on Clinton's casual proposal to completely destroy an entire kingdom just because it had pissed him off. For that matter, Clinton wouldn't have been in any position to be tossing off suggestions like that in the first place. Of course, Howard admitted grimly, it's probably at least as likely that if he'd won, he would have been assassinated by now. It's happened to more than one of our ancestors, after all. So at least we were spared that much. Not that it's going to make any difference in the end.
He drew a deep breath, and his hard eyes softened as he glanced at his brother. He and Samuel had always been close, despite the almost 10 years between their ages. He'd always admired Samuel, always known Samuel was fated to do great things for God and Mother Church. He knew his mother had been dismayed when Samuel chose the Schullerites. She might not have been a Wilson by birth, but she'd scarcely been blind to the way in which the heritage of the family into which she had married had pitted so many of its members against church corruption over the last 3 or 4 centuries. She'd understood what had drawn Samuel into the Order of Schuller, recognized his burning desire to do something to fight the evils he saw gathering about the temple. And she'd remembered what had happened to his great-grandfather just over 100 years ago now. Saint Everihard's grand vicarate had been the shortest in history, and whatever the official histories might say, no one ever doubted that his accidental fall had been the direct result of his efforts to reform the vicarate. And the Grand Vicarate of Grand Vicar Terrell, Samuel and Howard's granduncle, had been almost as short. There were no rumors to suggest Terrell's death had been arranged, but he'd been old and in ill health when he'd been raised to Langhorne's throne, without the vigor and energy which had characterized Everhard. His fellow vicars may have felt they could simply wait for natural causes to put an end to his reform efforts. Of course, it was also always possible the natural causes which had finally killed him had been nudged along just a bit, despite what anyone might have thought. "Well, Mother," Howard thought now, "you were right to worry. I'm just glad you and Father won't be here to see what happens. I'm sure you'll know anyway, but the writ says that from God's side all things make sense. I hope that's true, because from where I sit right this minute, there's neither sense nor sanity in what's about to happen. And there sure as Shan Wei isn't a trace of justice in it."
"What did you think of the wine?" Samuel asked calmly, and Howard snorted.
"I thought it was excellent. St. Hendrick's, wasn't it? The 64?
Samuel nodded serenely, and Howard snorted again, louder.
"Well, at least that's one thing Clinton won't get his pig hands on."
"Not exactly the reason I chose to serve it tonight, but a thought worth remembering, I suppose,"
Samuel agreed so serenely. A corner of Howard's innermost soul wanted to scream at him in frustration. That serenity, that total, always grounded faith, was one of the things Howard had always most admired in his brother. At the moment, however, it rasped on his nerves almost as much as it comforted him. And the real reason it did, however little he might want to examine the truth, was that Samuel's serenity, his acceptance of God's will, actually made Howard question his own faith. He'd fought that doubt with all his strength, yet he'd never been able to completely vanquish it. Surely, a truly just God, archangels who truly served the light, would never have abandoned a man as good as his brother, one who longed only to serve God and love his fellow man. Not simply abandon him, but deliver him into the hands of a vile, corrupt, evil man like Jaspar Clinton. Into the hands of a man prepared to slaughter an entire kingdom. The hands of a man who was armed with every terrible punishment of the Book of Schuller, and perfectly willing, eager, to inflict every single one of them upon blameless children of God whose only crime had been to resist his own corruption. Howard Wilson knew his own weaknesses, his own shortcomings. He couldn't really honestly say he thought any of them were so terrible as to justify the fate Clinton had in mind for him, either. Yet he was prepared to admit that he, too, had been prey to the sin of ambition. That, on occasion, he had allowed the seductive power of his birth and his office to lead him into taking the easy course, accepting the shortcut, using God instead of using himself in God's service. But he also knew Samuel hadn't done that. That Samuel truly had been the spiritual heir of Saint Everhard, and not just his descendant. What could God possibly be thinking to let the man who should have been his champion, the man who would willingly have embraced his own death to redeem his church, come to an end like this one? That wasn't the sort of question anyone, far less someone consecrated to the Orange, was supposed to ask of God. And a vicar of the Church of God Awaiting wasn't supposed to rail at God, indict him for abandoning even the most blameless of his servants. That was what faith was supposed to be for, to help a man accept what he could not understand. He started to say just that, to take his doubt, his anger, to Samuel as he'd done so often before, knowing his brother would listen without condemnation, then offer the quiet words of comfort or the gently stern words of admonition he needed to hear. But this time, no words could comfort the questions burning deep inside Howard Wilson, just as no words of admonition could banish them. And this time, he would not, could not, add the burden of his own doubt to the weight already crushing down upon his brother.
"At least we got as many of the junior members of the circle as we could out of Zion before the snows really set in," he reminded himself. And along the way, I think, some of the other vicars must have realized what Samuel was doing. I hope some of them did, anyway. That they were able to come up with plans which might give them at least a tiny hope of escaping when the Inquisitors come for us all. That's the only reason I can think of for so many of their families to have disappeared, at least. His eyes went back to the portraits of his brother's family. They had vanished as well, although he didn't think Samuel had arranged it. In fact, he'd been there when his brother received the letter from his wife, Lisbeth, informing him that she would be coming to the temple this winter after all, in spite of his specific instructions that she stay away. He'd seen the way Samuel's facial muscles had sagged, despite his best effort to hide his reaction, and he'd understood exactly why his brother had just aged 5 years in front of him. But then, still 3 days' journey short of Zion, Lisbeth and the children had disappeared one night. There'd been evidence of a struggle, but no sign of who the struggle might have been with, and Lisbeth, her two boys, and her daughter had simply vanished. At first, Samuel had looked even older and more defeated than before. But then, gradually, he'd realized that whatever else had happened, his family had not been quietly taken into custody by the Inquisition after all. No one seemed to have the least idea what had happened to them. And there had been at least some expressions of sympathy. But it was Jaspar Clinton's barely hidden fury which had convinced Howard the Inquisition truly hadn't had a thing to do with Samuel's family's abduction. Obviously, the kidnapping of a vicar's family had sparked one of the most intense manhunts in the history of Mother Church, yet not one single sign of the culprits had been discovered. Over the 5 days which had followed, Samuel had borne up nobly under the strain, as day after day passed with no ransom demand, no threat, no word at all. Howard was quite certain the Inquisition was still watching his brother, like King Wyverns waiting to pounce, hoping for some break, some communication, which would lead it to Lisbeth. After so long, though, even Clinton's agents seemed to be giving up hope of that. And it was probably Lisbeth's disappearance which had inspired some of the Circle's other members to make arrangements for their own families. Howard hoped those arrangements had been in time and that they were going to prove effective. "And I hope, pray, the others understand why we couldn't warn them directly." In his own mind, Howard had narrowed the suspects to no more than half a dozen. The problem was that he didn't know which of those half dozen might have turned informant, betrayed them all to Clinton, revealed the existence and membership of the Organization of Reformists. For that matter, he might have been wrong. The traitor might not be one of the people he was convinced it had to be. And they could warn none of the Circle's members without warning all of them, including the traitor. Had they done that, Clinton would have struck with instant, vicious power, rather than waiting until what he judged to be the perfect moment. Waiting, Howard was certain, so that he could savor the sweet bouquet of his coming triumph over the men who had dared to challenge his authority. And so they'd said nothing, using the time while Clinton waited to do what little they could to mitigate the blow when he finally pounced. Getting all of the junior bishops and archbishops they could out of Zion where they might be safe. Alerting their network of correspondents and agents outside the innermost circle to quietly prepare the deepest bolt holes they could contrive. "Thank God I never married," Howard thought. Maybe that was another way I had less faith than Samuel, because I was never willing to trust God enough to give up those hostages to someone like Clinton. "I understand Corus arrived this evening," he said out loud, and Samuel smiled faintly at his younger brother's obvious effort to find something safe to talk about. "Yes, so I heard," he replied, and shook his head. "That must have been a nightmare of a journey this time of year."
"I'm sure it was, but I doubt the thought particularly bothered Clinton or Trenaire," Howard said sourly. I suppose we should be grateful they didn't insist he dragged the boy along with him.
I'm sure they saw no need to, Samuel shrugged. He's only a little boy, Howard. For at least the next several years, Divin's going to do what he's told by his elders, simply because that's what he's accustomed to doing.
I imagine Clinton figures there's plenty of time to impress him with the realities of his position, let's say, before he gets old enough to turn into a headstrong young prince. Assuming he and Trenaire are willing to let the boy grow up at all.
Howard's tone was harsh, bitter. Yet it was less bitter than his eyes.
Assuming that, yes, Samuel was forced to concede. I've prayed about it. Of course I'd feel more optimistic if it didn't seem so evident. God has decided to let things work their own way out.
Howard's jaw muscles tightened again as he fought down yet another stab of anger. Still, as Samuel had pointed out more than once, God wouldn't have given man free will if he hadn't expected him to use it. And that meant those who chose to do evil could do evil. Which automatically implied that other men, and even little boys, could and would suffer the consequences of those evil actions. No doubt it truly was all part of God's great plan, but there were times, like now, when it seemed unnecessarily hard on the victims.
Well, I hope Corus is as smart as I've always heard he is, Howard said after a moment. That boy and his sister are going to need every edge they can find if they're going to survive.
This time, Samuel only nodded, his eyes softening briefly with affection. So like his brother, he thought, to be worrying about a little boy and a teenaged girl he'd never even met. That was the temple guardsman in him. The pugnacious protective streak which had driven him to serve God first with a sword, and only later with his heart and mind. He was glad Howard already knew how deeply he loved him, that neither of them had to say it at this time, in this place.
And on that note, Howard said, glancing at the clock on the wall, the clock which, like every other clock in the temple, always kept perfect, precisely synchronized time. And then climbing out of his chair. I'm afraid I have to be going. I've got a couple of errands I need to take care of tonight.
Anything I can help with? Samuel asked,
and Howard snorted yet again, this time much more gently.
You may not believe this, Samuel, but I've been buttoning my own shirt and tying my own shoes for, years now.
Point taken, Samuel chuckled softly. And I know you have. So go see to your errands. Supper tomorrow night at your place.
It's a date, Howard said,
then nodded to his brother and left.
Ha-choo!
The sneeze seemed to have taken the top right off of Vicar Robert Ducairne's head. Not even the temple's sacred, always comfortable precincts seemed capable of defeating the common cold. This was the third cold Ducairne had already entertained this winter, and this one looked like being worse than either of its predecessors. He paused long enough to get out his handkerchief and blow his nose, taking the opportunity to recover from the sneeze at the same time, then resumed his progress along the corridor. He was already late for the scheduled meeting, although timing wasn't actually all that critical. He was the Church of God Awaiting's treasurer, after all. The people waiting for him all reported to him, and it wasn't as if they could start things without him. And it wasn't as if he were really looking forward to the conference, for that matter. The treasury had been hemorrhaging money ever since the Kingdom of Caris smashed the initial attack upon it, and he didn't see that situation getting better any time soon. Especially not with the blow the church's cash flow had taken. Not only had the kingdoms of Caris and Chisholm and the princedoms of Emerald and Coruscant, not to mention the Grand Duchy of Zebediah, abruptly stopped paying their tithes, which in Caris's case had been very large tithes, but Caris's relentless destruction of its enemies' commerce had dealt severe damage to the economies of those enemies. And as their economy slowed, so did their ability to generate tithes. According to Ducairne's latest estimates, the cash flow from the mainland kingdom's annual tithes had dropped by somewhere around 10%, and total tithes, including those which should have been coming in from the lands now in rebellion against Mother Church, had fallen by over a third. It was fortunate the church had so many other lucrative sources of income, but there was a limit to how much slack could be squeezed out of those other sources. For the first time in mortal memory, the Church of God Awaiting was spending money faster than it was taking money in, and that sort of thing couldn't be sustained forever. Which, unfortunately, certain of his colleagues seemed to find difficult to grasp. His expression darkened as he thought about those other colleagues. Neither Trenaire nor Clinton had mentioned to him that they intended to interview the Earl of Corus this morning. He was fairly confident he had sources neither of those two suspected he possessed, but he wasn't going to risk revealing those sources' existence by challenging his colleagues on something he wasn't supposed to know anything about. He doubted either of them would have been prepared to make an issue out of it if he'd suddenly turned up for their interview, yet he was quite positive they deliberately timed things, so it just happened to fall opposite his already scheduled treasury meeting. Both of them, each for his own reasons, would have found Ducairne's presence for the discussion they had in mind decidedly unwelcome. And that, unfortunately, neatly underscored the differences between him and them, and the dangers yawning about him because of those differences. He paused, looking out the windows which formed one entire side of the hallway. The snow had stopped shortly after dawn, and brilliant sunlight sparkled and bounced from the new, deeper layers of trackless white which had blanketed the temple's grounds. The mystic, unbreakable, perfectly insulated crystal of the windows muted the snow glare, however, and the icy vista's pristine purity made him acutely aware of the warm air moving gently about him, and made him think about all the people outside the temple, especially the city of Zion's many poor, who were anything but warm and comfortable this freezing cold morning as well. That was yet another thought he was unprepared to share with his erstwhile colleagues in the group of four. Not because they didn't already realize it would have occurred to him, but because it would have done no good and might do quite a lot of harm. Zamson Trenaire would simply have looked at him with a certain impatient incomprehension. If the Church of God Awaiting's Chancellor ever thought of Zion's poor at all, it was undoubtedly to remember the passage from the Book of Langhorne, in which the archangel had warned that they would have the poor with them always. If that had been good enough for Langhorne, it was good enough for Trenaire. Elaine Maguire, on the other hand, probably wouldn't even notice that Ducairne had mentioned them. These days, especially, all of the church's Captain General's thoughts and efforts were fully concentrated on building up the fleet needed to crush the upstart Empire of Corus once and for all. The fact that he'd started out building the wrong fleet, and that Ducairne's treasury had dispersed a staggering sum to pay for hundreds of galleys, which were effectively useless, lent a certain emphasis to his concentration, no doubt. Of course, Maguire had never been overburdened with intellect in the first place. Concentrating the entire scant store of it he possessed shouldn't require all that great an effort. He should have been able to spare at least a little thought for the men and women and children, especially the children, for whom every vicar was supposed to be responsible. And then there was Clinton, the Grand Inquisitor, the one member of the group of four who would have regarded Ducairne's concern over the poor with neither incomprehension nor indifference. Ducairne sometimes wished he himself had felt called to the Order of Bedard instead of the Order of Chihiro. He was pretty sure any Bedardist who wasn't terrified of the Grand Inquisitor would have unhesitatingly diagnosed him as a paranoiac, and one whose paranoia was growing steadily deeper as well.
Of course, finding any bedardist who was insane enough not to be terrified of Clinton would probably have been an impossible task. Still, Ducerne would have liked to have something besides his own layman's opinion, where matters of the mind were concerned at least, to go on. Not that it mattered a great deal. He didn't need a formal diagnosis to know Clinton would have taken any comment about the writ's injunction to care for the poor and the least fortunate of God's children as a criticism of the church's record in that regard. As a matter of fact, he would have been perfectly correct if he'd done so too, Ducerne admitted. But at this particular moment, when Jaspar Clinton had divided the entire world into just three categories, those who were his allies, those who had an at least fleeting value as tools, and those who must be exterminated without mercy, suggesting that any aspect of the church's stewardship might be found wanting was dangerous. Ducerne had discovered there were times when he really didn't care about that. When his anger, his outrage, the pain stemming from his refound faith's recognition of his own blood guilt actually drove him to seek confrontation with Clinton. When he found himself almost yearning for destruction, even martyrdom, with all that would entail, as some sort of expiation for his own life, for his own acceptance of the vicarate's corruption, his own lifelong eagerness to profit by that corruption, for the fact that he'd stood there and not simply accepted Clinton's proposal to destroy the kingdom of Caris utterly, but actually acquiesced in it, helped to arrange it. Ducerne made himself resume his progress towards his waiting underlings, but his eyes were as bleak as the snow beyond the hallway's windows as he once more admitted his guilt to himself. He wouldn't pretend he wasn't terrified of what Clinton would have done to him if it had come to an open confrontation. That he didn't know precisely how savage an example Clinton would make of any member of the group of four who seemed to have turned against him. Yet it wasn't that fear which drove him to bite his tongue, keep his furious denunciation of Clinton's vileness lodged behind his clenched teeth. No, it was quite a different fear that kept him silent, the fear that if he allowed himself to be too easily destroyed, he would commit the still more grievous sin of dying without at least trying to undo the terrible, terrible damage he had helped to unleash upon God's own world.
"Not that I've figured out how to go about undoing any of it yet," he admitted desolately. "Maybe that's part of my penance. Is it part of my punishment to be forced to watch things getting worse and worse without seeing any way to make them better again? But the writ says God will always find a way, whether man can or not. So maybe what he really wants me to do is to stop trying so hard, stop being so arrogant as to think I can somehow fix a disaster on a worldwide scale. Maybe he wants me to finally accept that I need to let him show me what to do, and then..."
Robert Ducerne's thoughts were abruptly interrupted as he walked full tilt into a wall someone had inconsiderately left in the exact center of the hallway. That was what it felt like, at any rate, although the wall's sudden oof suggested it might not actually have been the solid granite obstruction it appeared to be. He staggered backwards, almost falling. In fact, he would have fallen if someone's hands hadn't caught him by the upper arms and held him upright. He shook his head, cold-clogged ears ringing, and his eyes widened as they refocused on the face of the man he'd run into. Ducerne was not a short man, but neither was he a giant. In fact, he'd always been on the slender side, and his had been a decidedly sedentary life for the last 20 or 30 years. The man with whom he'd just collided was half a head taller than he, broad-shouldered and powerfully built, and he'd obviously spent the last several years of his own life exercising to maintain the physical toughness he'd enjoyed as a senior officer of the Temple Guard. He must outweigh Ducerne by a good 40 or 50 pounds, and very little of that weight advantage was fat. And he also happened to be named Howard Wilson.
Ducairn found himself temporarily paralyzed, staring into eyes of Wilson Gray. They were hard, those eyes, with polished, quartz-like purpose. The eyes of a man who, unlike Robert Ducairn, had never compromised with the temple's corruption. Of a man who had every reason to fear Jaspar Clinton, and no reason at all to fear God.
"You want to be a bit more careful, Robert," Wilson said, setting him fully back on his feet before he released his grip on Ducairn's arms.
He patted the smaller man almost gently, as if to be certain there was no breakage, and his smile was thin.
"You might do yourself a mischief running into people like that. Life's too short to take that sort of chance, don't you think?"
Wilson cocked his head slightly with the question, and Ducairn felt an icicle run through his veins. There was something about Wilson's tone, something about the glitter of those hard eyes.
"He knows," Ducairn thought. "He knows I warned his brother. And God help me, he knows Clinton is going to kill both of them, and that I don't have the courage to try to stop him."
The church's treasurer felt his mouth open without having the least notion of what was going to come out of it, but then Wilson shook his head. It was a quick gesture, one that stopped whatever Ducairn might have been about to say cold.
"Of course it is," the doomed man said. "Too short, I mean. There are too many things we all need to do to just throw away the time to do them in. Doesn't the writ say God sets the course for every man to run?"
"Yes," Ducairn heard himself say. "Yes, it does."
"Well, then I don't imagine he's through with any of us until we've finished running it. So be more careful."
He actually smiled faintly, wagging an index finger under Ducairn's nose.
"Watch where you're walking, or else you won't have time to do all the running God has in mind for you."
It took every ounce of Ducairn's self-control to clamp his mouth on what he wanted to say. He looked into those gray eyes, and he didn't really trust himself to speak at all when he realized what was truly looking back at him out of them. Wilson only smiled at him again, gently this time, and gave him another pat, then turned and walked away.
"The Earl of Corris, Your Holiness," the upper priest said, as he bowed Philip Osgood into the small private meeting chamber.
It wasn't very much of a bow, Corris reflected. Then again, the upper priest was assigned to the Chancellor's office. He probably saw dukes by the dozen and earls by the score, and God only knew how many bevies of mere barons he might encounter every year. Not to mention the fact that most of the dukes and earls who crossed his path weren't dispossessed exiles living on someone else's charity.
"So I see," a voice replied. "Come in, my lord."
Corris obeyed the summons and found himself facing a tallish, lean man with an angular face, a closely trimmed beard, and deep, intelligent eyes. He wore the orange cassock of a vicar, and he matched the description of Vicar Zompson Trenaire quite well. Trenaire extended his hand, and Corris bent to kiss the sapphire ring, then straightened.
"Your Holiness," he acknowledged.
"We appreciate the promptness with which you've responded to our summons, my lord, especially at this time of the year," Trenaire said.
His smile never touched his eyes.
"Would that all of Mother Church's sons were so mindful of their duty to her."
"I won't pretend it wasn't an arduous journey, Your Holiness,"
Corris allowed himself a slight wry smile of his own.
"But as a boy, I was always taught that when Mother Church calls, her sons answer. And it was also interesting, especially the voyage across Lake Pei, while the opportunity to finally visit the temple is an added blessing." "Good!"
The single perfunctory word came not from Trenaire, but from the shorter, portly, silver-haired, heavy-jowled vicar who hadn't bothered to rise when Corris entered. There was no doubt about his identity either, the Earl thought, although he was just a bit surprised to realize Jaspar Clinton matched so completely the descriptions he'd received. Right down to the spots spilled food had left on his cassock.
There ought to be a rule that real villains aren't allowed to look like stereotypical villains, Corus thought, and felt a tiny shiver run through him as he realized how he'd just allowed himself to describe Clinton. It wasn't really a surprise. He'd been headed in that direction for years, after all. Yet there was an odd sense of commitment to the moment, as if he'd crossed some irrevocable bridge, even if he was the only one who realized he had.
And you'd damned well better make sure you stay the only one who realizes you have, Philip, he told himself.
From Clinton's expression, he didn't much care what might be going through Corus's mind at the moment. Nor did he appear to feel tempted to expend any courtesy on their visitor. Where Trenaire's eyes held the cool dispassion of a chess master, Clinton's glowed with the fervor of a zealot. A fervor which confirmed Corus's long-standing opinion that Clinton was, by far, the more dangerous of the two.
"Please be seated, my lord," Trenaire invited, indicating the single chair on Corus's side of the meeting room table.
It was the simplest chair Corus had yet seen inside the temple, a straight-backed, apparently unpadded, utilitarian piece of furniture. It was certainly a far cry from the throne-like chairs in which Trenaire and Clinton were ensconced. Yet when he settled onto it, he almost jumped back to his feet in astonishment, as what had appeared to be a simple wooden surface seemed to shift under him. It moved, flowed, and he couldn't keep his eyes from widening as the chair shaped itself perfectly to the configuration of his body. He looked up to see Trenaire regarding him speculatively and made himself smile at the Chancellor. It was an expression which blended an admission of surprise with a sizable dollop of boyish enjoyment, and Trenaire allowed himself the small chuckle of a host who has successfully surprised a guest. Clinton, predictably probably, seemed completely oblivious to the small moment, Corus noted.
"Best not to assume anything of the sort, Philip," he told himself. "I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Clinton's long since figured out just how useful it can be to have potential opponents underestimate one's powers of observation. The only thing in the world more dangerous than a fool, especially when it comes to the great game, is a smart man you've assumed is stupid. Narmon should certainly have taught you that much."
"Well," Trenaire began briskly after a moment, "now that you're here, my lord, I suppose we ought to get right down to business. As you know, I have, as Mother Church's Chancellor, and acting on Grand Vicar Eric's specific instructions, formally recognized young Prince Divan as the rightful ruler of Coruscant. Given his tender years, it struck us as unnecessary to bring him all the way to the temple to discuss his future with him. You, on the other hand, are his legal guardian. Since we do not, and never will, recognize that travesty of a regency council Caleb and Charlian have foisted upon God, we also regard you as the closest thing Divan has at this time to a true regent."
He paused, as if inviting comment, but Corus wasn't about to rush into that particular snare. He contented himself with a slow nod of understanding and an attentive expression instead.
"In light of the circumstances," the Chancellor resumed a few seconds later, "we think it's essential to regularize Divan's position. While he would appear to be safe enough for the moment under the protection of King James, especially given the fact Delphirac is already at war with the apostates, there are certain aspects of his situation which we feel require formal clarification."
He paused once more, and this time it was obvious he intended to stay paused until Corus responded.
"Formal clarification, Your Holiness," the Earl obediently repeated. "May I ask what sort of clarification?"
"Oh, come now, my lord."
Clinton entered the discussion, waving one hand in a dismissive gesture.
"You are Prince Hector's spymaster. You know how the game is played, if anyone does."
"Your Holiness," Corus replied, choosing his words more carefully than he'd ever chosen words in his life before.
"You're right. I was Prince Hector's spymaster.
but if you'll forgive me for saying so, my perspective from a single princedom that far from the temple couldn't possibly be the same as your perspective from right here, at the heart of all of Mother Church's concerns, and at the focus of all of the avenues of information Mother Church possesses. I'll admit I've spent a lot of time trying to analyze the information I do have in an effort to anticipate what it is you and the Chancellor have called me here to explain. I'm not foolish enough, however, to assume for a moment that I have enough information to make any sort of truly informed deductions. I can think of several aspects of Prince Divan's current situation which might require clarification. But without a better understanding of precisely how Prince Divan, and I, of course, can best serve Mother Church, I truly don't know how you and Vicar Zompson may wish to proceed. Trinair's eyes had flickered with what might have been irritation when Clinton spoke up. Now the Chancellor sat back in his own chair, folding his hands together on the table before him, his expression thoughtful. Clinton, on the other hand, gave Corus an oddly triumphant little smile, as if the Earl's response had passed some sort of test.
"We're naturally relieved to learn you've been thinking about how best Divan and you yourself can serve Mother Church," the Grand Inquisitor said,
and the emphasis on the word "you" was as unmistakable as the glow in his eyes.
"I feel confident we'll be able to rely as fully upon your intelligence and diligence as Prince Hector ever did."
"And we'd damned well better be able to, eh, Your Holiness? Is that it?"
Corus thought trenchantly. However intelligent Clinton might actually be, he was dangerously transparent in at least some ways. Of course, when a man controlled all the levers of power that came together in the office of the Grand Inquisitor, he could probably afford a certain degree of transparency, at least when it suited his own purposes to come straight to the point.
"I'll certainly do my very best to justify your confidence, Your Holiness," he said out loud.
"Then I hope you'll understand what I'm about to say reflects no lack of confidence in you personally, my lord," Trinair said.
Corus looked back at him, and the Chancellor shrugged very slightly.
"Under the circumstances, the Grand Vicar deems it best to formally vest authority as Prince Divan's regent in the vicarate, rather than in any secular noble. His father was martyred by the champions of apostasy and impious heresy. The Grand Vicar believes it is incumbent upon Mother Church to openly and expressly extend her protection to Prince Hector's heir."
"Of course, Your Holiness," Corus replied.
He was confident, Trinair would assume, accurately, that he recognized that business about Grand Vicar Eric as pure fiction. Trinair had hand-selected the current Grand Vicar from a short list of suitable puppets years ago, and if Eric had ever cherished a single independent thought since assuming the Grand Vicar's throne, that thought had undoubtedly perished of loneliness long since.
"In many ways," Trinair continued, "that change will represent little more than a technicality. As I suggested earlier, there's no need to further destabilize young Divan's life at this time. Better to leave him where he is, under the care of someone he trusts and knows is looking out for his best interests."
"Especially if the someone he trusts is looking out for the interests of the Church, or of the Group of Four at least, instead," Corus thought.
"And to be frank, my lord," Clinton said, "we're of the opinion that it won't hurt a bit to have a man with your particular set of skills and experiences watching over him."
Corus looked at him, and the Grand Inquisitor shrugged his beefy shoulders.
"After all, Caleb's already murdered the boy's father. There's no telling when someone like him, or that bitch Charlian, might decide the time's come to make a clean sweep of the entire House of Dakin. I understand they're confronting considerable popular unrest in Coruscant. They might just come to the conclusion that it would be a good idea to remove young Divan as a potential focus for the more restive elements of the princedom's population."
"I see, Your Holiness."
Corus prayed that the icicle which had just danced down his spine wasn't apparent to either of the vicars.
Obviously, I discussed Prince Divan's security with King James before I left Talkeira. As you say, I don't think we could be too careful where his safety is concerned. And I assure you that once I return to Delphirac, I'll exercise personal oversight of his security arrangements.
Good, Clinton smiled broadly. I feel confident our decision to rely upon you and your judgment will prove well placed, my lord.
As do I, Trenaire seconded. In the meantime, however, we have several other points to discuss, the Chancellor went on. I'm sure it will take us several sessions to cover all of them, and you will, of course, remain the Temple's honored guest until we've completed them. For the moment, what we'd really like to do, though, is to pick your brain a little bit. Obviously, we've had many reports about the situation in Coruscant and the attitude of the Coruscantian people, but you're a Coruscantian yourself. And one who was extremely well-placed to see the consequences of Caleb's invasion from Coruscant's viewpoint. No doubt there have been many changes since your own departure from the princedom, but you still represent a priceless resource from our perspective. There are many points on which we would greatly appreciate hearing anything you can tell us. For example, which of Prince Hector's, I mean Prince Divan's now, nobles do you think would be most likely to organize effective resistance against the Carizian occupation?
Well, I can see this is going to take some time, Corus thought dryly. Still, best to be careful about how we proceed, especially when we don't know how much information they've already got. That's a complicated question, Your Holiness, he began. I can think of at least a dozen of Prince Hector's closer allies among the Coruscantian knights who are almost certainly thinking in those directions. Without a better feel than I have at this time, please do recall that I've been traveling for the better part of 4 months, which has prevented me from setting up any sort of proper network. I would suspect those farther from Manchir would be in a better position to act upon such thoughts, however. Bearing that in mind, I'd be inclined to think the Earl of Storm Keep and the Earl of Craggy Hill have probably already begun to take steps along exactly those lines. Neither of them are going to feel particularly well disposed towards Caleb and Charlian, and both are located well up to the north, out of easy reach from the capital. Moving back to the south and west, he continued, I wouldn't be dreadfully surprised to find Earl Blackwater, that would be Sir Adulfo, the new Earl, is headed in the same direction. For that matter, the Duke of Barcaire is probably similarly inclined, and,